This is Susan Nash. I'm here today with Rochelle Owens, and we have a few questions, but first I'd like to introduce her as a poet, playwright, recognized in Europe and also the United States, and debuted in New York, winner of many, many awards. So welcome, Rochelle.
I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me, Susan.
Well, right now, I am very curious about the play that was the one that you last wrote. You wrote it while you were in Oklahoma, and the name of the play is Three Front. Can you talk to us a little bit about it?
I realize now that I made a mistake. I actually wrote it in New York, but also might have done additional writing in Norman, Oklahoma.
Okay, well, what is the play about?
It's essentially, it's called Three Front, and don't want to use the word basically. Young people often use that word. I will say that the play is about people living at the extremes of experience. Now, what does that actually mean? It means that the events in their life are so emblematic of their motives that they are full-blown behaviors of potential disaster and disappointment. Now, the play is told as much by the visual elements that the director will utilize to stage for the theatrical experience, and the speeches, the dialogue, the interaction of actors will reveal their emotional states and their motives too.
So essentially it's about a toxic waste dump that figures in the middle of it, but then there's all sorts of intrigue and action about it.
Very good at saying intrigue and action about it. Question. Okay, I'm reflecting. So in this interview, if a gap or pause, it's because I am reflecting. Just like in a theatrical production, there are pauses. I will continue. And so the play has three characters, and they are at war with each other. In a sense, the translation of the play into French, and the title, because the play was translated into French by the theatrical and innovative writer, Lillian Atlan. Lillian Atlan, a formidable poet and dramatist and French writer, translated Three Front from the original English, which I wrote, into French. And so the title is Guerre à Trois, meaning three people at war. And there are three characters, and sometimes that one of the female characters becomes two. And again, it is about a toxic waste enterprise. And the locales are a city in America and one in Thailand and also Salzburg, Germany. Those are the three locales where the play will unfold. Now, my instruction for the directorial process is that the lighting might be considered as the most important, The lighting could be considered the most important single element in a series of changing scenes and flashbacks that fuse the past and present. I love lighting in the theater. With the lighting of the theater, the most simple stage elements can be turned into experiences capture both the interior and exterior qualities of the characters and what the play is about. Lighting is magic, and the darkness and the light, like the Caravaggio painter who employed that, and then that formidable Renaissance painter, Artemisia. Are you please correct me, Susan?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. Artemisia Gentileschi.
Yes, she employed the quality of lighting. And so the theater. And by the way, these people probably would have been cinematic directors if they lived in modern times. Artemisia very well could have been a cinema, made films, just as, of course, the great Caravaggio.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Yes, they would have worked in cinema, creating stupendous, beautiful works of film, just as Fellini and other people, Italians or otherwise.
So in Three Front, you have a lot of sort of chiaroscuro and people in the dark or in the light or shadowed.
Yes, the director, Joanne Schmidman, utilized lighting and wonderful, innovative theatrical ways, highlighting, darkening, etc.
So what is the emotion that the theater goers feel when they watch Three Front?
Hopefully, they are caught up in the play as event. Each spectator brings their own character, their own experience, their own wit, and their own intelligence. And some might very well be frightened, bored, angered, or deeply involved. I have no idea. It's so varied, but I do know and have known audience response. You feel it if you happen to be there. You can feel it.
And it's so interesting because you take that kind of intense involvement and engagement of the reader and reader response to your poetry as well. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about Patterns of Animus, which is your latest work.
Oh, thank you, Susan, for bringing that up. I would like to. Patterns of Animus. It occurred to me when the seeds of desire to start a new poem that I wanted to investigate life energy, regardless of moral standards. I was caught up in the idea of mammals, how we as mammals, all mammals, we have a face with eyes, various appendages like arms, hands, legs, elephant or human, and how from human beings have been out of Africa, where supposedly evolved, or came out of Africa 60,000 years ago, about. Before that, 5 million years ago, they have found an older anatomical portions of human beings. There was Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, etc. All were evolved to live on the earth out of the sea. They claim that first the mammal creatures lived in the sea and then somehow crawled out onto the land. Our mothers and fathers, there's a beautiful line that says, mother and father crawled onto the land. Okay, it has that. And so we as mammals were suited to the planet perfectly. And yet in modern times, you know what we're, not you and I, but what the nasty, corrupt impulse to destroy the planet. And of course, there are wonderful, ecologically inclined people who have invested their energies into that.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned destructive energy and kind of apocalyptic energy, because one of the passages in Patterns of Animus has repetitions of, like, the cosmos is a great tapeworm. And I find that to be really fascinating. How and why is a tapeworm in the cosmos?
A tapeworm is terribly ugly, terribly hideous. And I wanted to wrestle with that concept. Just as Jacob in the Bible wrestled with an unknown figure, and he, or she, maybe Jacob was a woman. We don't know. But that's a whole other discourse. Okay. I wanted to wrestle with that hideous concept of a tapeworm that lives as a parasite in mammals as well as human beings. It's a very bleak, ugly, creepy concept. And I'm going to read that section, and then I'm going to spontaneously find things in it. Off the cuff, is that okay?
Yeah, that's great.
What does off the cuff mean again?
Spontaneously.
Great, great, okay. I think it was, yes, I think it was Nietzsche. Oh, by the way, I do have four philosophies. I use a quote from them, and it ignited my imagination. Now, this is very interesting. Here's a quote. I think it's Nietzsche who said that, Dostoevsky. But it's a bleak and formidable observation. When you look into an abyss, the abyss looks into you. And that ignited my imagination. And so I begin this section of the poem, because the poem is pretty long. And yes, Patterns of Animus is a long poem that Textured Press, you're the publisher, published. And I was very happy that it was published by Textured Press. It was first published online by Jerome Rothenberg, very important poet and anthologist. And Jerome Rothenberg would publish it online, any of my poems that I would give him, for many, many years. Jerry Rothenberg has published, it's called, I'm trying to recall the name of his site, Poems and Poetics. Okay, when you look into an abyss, the abyss looks into you. Here's my poem. In the beginning, Earth undertook experiments. There were many freaks, bizarrely put together. Fluttering your eyelashes, you chew the rind of a lemon and suck in your cheeks. A flow of hormonal forces. Your blood-packed tongue and bulbous eyes move constantly. Digital letters spell carnal, spiritual. Spirals of colors pulsate. Zigzags of black lines, vertical, horizontal. Digital letters spell. An outline shapes itself. Biomorphic, geomorphic, polymorphic, inhaling, exhaling with each breath, a sucking sound. The camera zooms and pans. The body of a scorpion walking with its legs in a strange rhythmical arrangement. Animal soul, spiritual whole. You are about to play the role of your life. Blood in, blood out. Work is a binding obligation. Black and hot, my coffee. Disease, famine, torture, war. That is a section that goes into this process, biomorphic, geomorphic, with each breath a sucking sound.
It's really powerful, and the fact that it's repeated, woven into the poem, and it appears several times, it just builds and builds in intensity.
Yes, it does. In fact, what you said is very good in terms of me focalizing on this particular section, which will bring forth the taper. Another quote. I think it's Nietzsche, or I don't remember if it's Nietzsche or Dostoevsky, but that's okay for me to say that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Here's the quote. It's so true, this quote. Nature doesn't ask your permission. It doesn't care about your wishes or whether you like its laws or not. The philosopher Dostoevsky or Nietzsche might have said that, could have said that. I don't believe it was Ludwig Wittgenstein.
No. I agree with you.
Now the poem from which the poem's energy and inspiration that I had was ignited by that quotation. Nature doesn't ask for permission. It doesn't care about your wishes or whether you like its laws or not. Now the poem. Unforeseen, drifting along the element. Pardon me. Let's begin again. Unforeseen. Drifting along the alimentary canal, humming, singing, whistling. The tapeworm blowing kisses. A phenomenal talent of melody swiveling along your gut wall. Stretching. Stretching his neck from right to left. Gushing, spurting, squirting. Swaying side to side, the body of the tapeworm, seized with jittery energy, shakes, rattles, and rolls. Rhythmic, the ecstasy of master worm. Rhythmic, the ecstasy of master worm. Trembling, ejaculating. Ha, dense fireballs, spermatozoon. A ferocious scattering. Neutron stars, black holes, behold! The universe contracts, expands. Work is a binding obligation, black and hot, my coffee. Disease, famine, torture, war.
It's just so brilliant to think of the tapeworm as a foundational structural metaphor for how the cosmos works. I mean, you start about with the tapeworm in the gut, but then it expands out, and that is the function of the universe.
Yes, the universe, the cosmos. Yes, I love
the cosmos.
That direction here and there, and it's the same mindless energy without God.
And it's all about using energy to survive And it's ultimately parasitic. Like, that's a really powerful commentary.
Well, because, yes, you're right, because in relationship to what they know about the dying stars and the black holes, there is, the astrophysicists, they point out this constant devouring of stars by other stars, and this black hole and energy, and it's all physics, and of course the advancement of physics, which is material, or what I say, matter, energy, motion, and force. Matter, energy, motion, and force. That includes the stars who are devouring other stars. That is matter. The tapeworm as a parasite. It is what...
I mean, it's a tremendous ironic twist to the notion of the Ouroboros, Greek Ouroboros, that constantly metamorphoses by swallowing its own tail. In this case, it's a parasitic relationship that causes the transformation. And that actually makes sense, because how many times can the same snake swallow its same tail and turn into different things? But if it's a parasite, it can be different every time it devours a different kind of energy.
Yes, it's true, and it is a very bleak, it's a bleak vision if you are not a Stoic.
Mm-hmm.
Stoicism would say that if you judge, oh, this is bad, you create disappointment and maybe sometimes grief to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Anger. Oh, it is not going the way I want it to. The mm-hmm. world is not going according to what I want. This person has failed in my expectations. It's because we have the erroneous belief that people, i.e. other things that exist, must do as we bid or must act with our moral judgment, where the Stoic says people are complicated and they are not, and the world isn't according to what you will it to be.
I really like what you're having to say, and I think that the juxtaposition of that, like, massive scale of energy and basically, oh, revival or redividing, et cetera, just different processes of creating energy, create a fascinating backdrop, because then you go from the macrocosm to a microcosm.
Yes. I believe it was Nietzsche who said this quote, and I am very intent upon the physical material of us as mammals who evolved so we could walk on the land and reach and do things with our hands and our feet, our breath. Baby's first response to being on the planet is a healthy breath. Breathe. There is on the planet the qualities for our breath so that we might live. Okay. And Nietzsche said, the French say Nietzsche, we say Nietzsche, quote, there is more wisdom in your body than in your deepest philosophy. And so the poem, the next section of the poem, after that quotation from, that brief quotation of Nietzsche, the next section of the poem begins, as the planets orbit the sun, saliva pools behind your teeth. As the planets orbit the sun, saliva pools behind your teeth. Before drought and hunger, the clouds, the rain, snow, hail, storms, thunder, lightning bolts, before the notion of peaceful humility, a ferocious scattering, amorous, the greedy seed, cold at dawn, warm at midday, boiling at midnight, rays of light penetrate the dome of your skull, the brain contracting, expanding. When your eyes move, a latent image appears, disappears, swiveling along your gut wall, a jagged black line, splits, zigzagging, breaks apart, embedding the fat and sleek little wormlets, growing, regenerating, craving, licking, sucking. Digital letters spell sight, smell, taste. Digital letters spell sight, smell, taste. Hungry or thirsty, eat or drink. The camera zooms and pans. Glowing particles of charred fish skin, a loaf of bread, a glass of water. Work is a binding obligation. Black and hot my coffee. Disease, famine, torture, war. Let's
take a break. That's amazing. So I really, really think that what is most moving to me is to see how this work shows how poetry moves beyond language itself into the pure conceptual, to be able to envision reality in ways that we can't if we just use regular types of language. But at any rate, I want to thank you, Rochelle, for talking to us today and wish you the best.
Thank you very much, Susan. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you.
We're finished now.